This sixth talk in a series on the Gospel of John was presented by Ryan Carroll on March 6, 2022. Scripture readings precede the teaching. Questions follow the teaching.
I'm going to read a couple passages from the Old Testament, New International Version, starting with the book of Isaiah, chapter 25, verses 6 through 9. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted him and he saved us. This is the Lord. We trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. And this reading from Amos 9, 13 through 15. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and I will bring my people Israel back from exile. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God.
I will be reading from Psalm 104, verses 1 through 4, verses 10 through 15, and verses 31 through 33. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a cloak, stretching out heaven like a tent curtain. He lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind. He makes the winds his messengers, flaming fire his ministers. He sends forth springs in the valleys. They flow between the mountains. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They lift their voices among the branches. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of his works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, the vegetation for the labor of men, so that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine which makes man's heart glad, so that he may make his face glisten with oil, and food which sustains man's heart. Let the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord be glad in his works. He looks at the earth, and it trembles. He touches the mountains, and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being.
John 2, 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some water out now, and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, Every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Good morning, everybody. We are in John chapter 2, first section, verses 1 through 11 today. And there's a celebration going on in this story. So that's kind of cool. I really like this narrative, this event. One of the things that we're going to notice is that there are two layers to this thing. It's on the one hand, there's of course the literal events, the literal level of what happened, who said what, what's going on. And on the other hand, we're going to see that there is a second level, there is a symbolic level. And the question is, when is a story about a wedding and wine not just a story about wedding and wine? And why do I say symbolic? Well, John has, as we know, John has kind of contextualized this story in a context that immediately preceding, we have Jesus' words to his disciples. Nathanael, you think me telling you I saw you under the fig tree was a big deal? Wait until you see these greater things that I'm going to do, right? And then he goes on to say, you are going to see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Essentially, you're going to see my glory, right? And we also, in the preceding, we've had John the Baptist's testimony, right? That we've come to expect that this is someone significant. This is someone who is the Messiah. This is the one who was foretold that was coming by Isaiah. So we're, as readers, we're in this space where we've been primed to see something really significant potentially here happening. And of course, don't forget the prologue, right? The word of God become flesh and we've beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. And of course, John ends the story by telling us that Jesus has in some way manifested his glory in the events that happened in this wedding. So we do have the text and what the author has done to push us into this symbolic sort of question of well, wait a second, is this just about a wedding? Is this just about wine? Is it just a cheap party trick that Jesus did here? And so to answer that question, of course, we'll get there and we're going to talk about that. But we want to look at the literal level first, okay? Okay, so here we are, chapter 2, verse 1. It was on the third day. Now, reminder, the last several weeks we have been in John's Gospel after the prologue, and I mentioned to you that we have a series of days. And this is going to be the final day that John records specifically in this series, right? And that once this day, this third day is over in Cana, he's not going to start marking days again until Passover week at the end of Jesus's ministry. And we may get to the chance to talk about those parallels. We may not, but you could ask me about them. So it's the third day. This is the final day in the series of what I believe are 7 days. If you count them, you probably won't find seven, but I believe they're 7 days. Why the third day? Well, it potentially was the third day of the week. Okay, so he's marked what day it was. Now, symbolically, are there other resonances? Maybe, maybe not. But he's at this wedding. It's this third day, and it's in Cana. Cana was a town that was about 12 kilometers north of Nazareth. So Cana was not itself on the Sea of Galilee. It was above, as you head up on the road toward northern Israel, Mount Hermon area. So here they are, and the guest list includes Jesus, Jesus' mother, and Jesus' disciples. It is likely the case that Jesus and Jesus' mother were potentially relatives. We don't know this for sure, but that they're both there could indicate that this is, in fact, a wedding of a relative. Okay, so that's the setting, right? And now we have the problem, right? And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, verse 3, they have no wine. This is the problem. All right. So the mother of Jesus said, right? Mary brings this issue up with Jesus. What is Mary doing here? That's the question. What's her motivation? What is she hoping, in essence, is going to happen? Is she merely like explaining to Jesus, like, wine's gone, dang. Is it purely explanatory? It could be. She could also be asking Jesus to fix the problem, right? This is the problem. And you could maybe do something about it. The wine's given out, right? Fix this. Now, the question is, would Mary at this point have like a warrant for believing that Jesus could do something about it? We don't have a full, complete answer to that. But clearly, this is early in Jesus' ministry. Certainly, Mary is aware of who her son is. Certainly, that's true. She knows his true identity. She had the angel come to her when, you know, before his birth. She witnessed all of the miracles and signs around his birth. She knows who he is, right? On some level. Does she know that he can do things, can potentially do miraculous things? We don't fully know, but it appears as though that one option is she has a sense that he can do something about it, and she's asking him to fix it. So it is really also true that it is likely that Mary, if she's a part of this family who is hosting the wedding, she is going to feel like huge shame and discomfort on behalf of her family, who is now facing down this reality, especially in first century Israel. Weddings were a big deal. Wine at weddings were a big deal. These weddings would last for days, potentially at a time. And it was not considered honorable at all to run out of, especially wine. So it is a big deal, and Mary must be feeling on some level this like tension here, this shame, this desire and discomfort to like on behalf of the hosts. And so somewhere in there, Mary's looking for something to happen, right? Now, given that after the exchange between Mary and Jesus happened, she then tells the servants, do whatever he says. It seems to me that on some level, Mary does look to Jesus, does believe that he may have the ability to fix it. But we can talk about that. So Jesus' response, they have no wine, Jesus. And Jesus' response is, woman, what do I have to do with you? My hour has not yet come. This, now, I'm sure many of you have heard people say, like, of course Jesus isn't being rude to his mother. This is like part of how, you know, that this people would speak to women this way. This isn't being rude, that sort of thing. So I don't really want to focus on that so much, but Jesus' response, what do I have to do with you? My hour is not yet come, is pretty important. Now, one other thing I do want to mention is that Mary is only mentioned twice in this gospel, okay? The first time is here. The second time and only other time is at the cross at the feet of Jesus when he's dying, okay? Both times, the author calls her simply the mother of Jesus. And both times when Jesus speaks directly, both times Jesus speaks directly to her, and both times he calls her woman. I think that's interesting, okay? And in fact, there's wine here at this time, and there's sour wine at the cross. I think that's also interesting. We can maybe talk about that later. Okay, so literally, Jesus's response is, the NASB translates it, "What do I have to do with you?" Like, it sounds kind of rude, right? Literally, in the Greek, it is, "What to me and to you?" What to me and to you? Okay? And so the question is, what does this mean? And I don't have like a full answer, but I do want you to know that this is a Hebrew idiom. It comes up several times in the Old Testament. It also comes up one other time in the New Testament, both in the Gospel of Mark and in the Gospel of Luke. Same story, the demoniac who's got a legion of demons inside of him. When Jesus shows up, the demoniac like falls to the ground and says, "Jesus, Son of God, what to me and to you?" Okay, what to me and to you? So this isn't like, my point is that this is not an uncommon sort of idiom, all right? And it could mean, there's two potential meanings. It could mean something like, "I'm frustrated with you. Why are you bugging me about this?" That could be the meaning. And another possible meaning is, and it's just there are shades here, is that this is not something that concerns me or you. What is this thing to me and to you? Okay? And I'm of the opinion that it's likely that Jesus is not attempting to be rude to his mother, but he's essentially saying, this is not something that ultimately concerns me or you, okay? And he follows that up by saying, "For my hour has not yet come," right? So there's something here that Jesus is kind of juxtaposing. He's saying, okay, here we are at this wedding. The wine has given out. You've come to me to tell me that this is an issue. I understand that. How exactly does this concern me ultimately when the thing that's most important to me is my hour? Okay, is my hour. Now, if we look in through the rest of John's gospel, Jesus will refer to this hour, and John will also refer to Jesus's hour. And ultimately, what we find is that the hour points to the moment or the time when Jesus is going to be elevated on the cross, die, and ultimately resurrect and be resurrected. So in John's gospel, the hour is the ultimate moment of glory for Jesus. The hour when he is crucified, dies, and resurrects. Okay, so not literal like 60 minutes, but this time that's important. And so in essence, Jesus is saying something along the lines of, Mary, I understand that, like, I'm not quite sure how and what you want me to do about this right now. I get that this is important. Ultimately, what's the most important thing is my hour, okay? Now, hold on to that for a second. So what are the options, essentially? If that's true, what are the options for what Mary is asking? And what is Jesus responding to? So Mary says they have no wine. Jesus says, "What to me and to you? My hour is not yet come." I have three possible options here, and we can talk about them further. The first option is that Mary's insistence of verse 2 later in the story towards the servants to do whatever her son tells them seems to tell against the option that Mary is simply informing Jesus that there's a problem, right? She wants action on this. Second option, that Mary is actually asking for Jesus to fix the problem. She wants to honor her hosts. And Jesus' response in this case, in this scenario, is, "This is not a problem that directly involves me. I've come for bigger things than just to be a fixer of problems. I came in order to meet my hour." Okay? That's option two. Option three, Mary wants Jesus to fix the problem, but she wants him to do it in a way that publicly will show who he is. Okay? She knows him to be the Messiah of Israel. She wants him to fix it and in the process to be able to essentially start this like King of Israel thing that she's been waiting for, right? So if that option is the correct one, then Jesus' response is essentially saying, this is not the true time and place for me to ultimately reveal my identity. Okay? And interestingly, what we're going to see is this miracle that ends up happening is not a public miracle. There are very few people, relatively speaking, who actually know that the miracle took place. Okay? The fourth option is that Mary is upset because her son Jesus, the Messiah's honor, is being disrespected by the hosts because they have no wine to honor the occasion that her son is a guest at. Okay, now, we can talk about why that could potentially be a thing. If that is what Mary's on about, that Mary is somehow offended for Jesus' sake, then Jesus' response is that, hey, Mary, this is not a, what to me to you? This is not a problem. This is not the hour of my glorification. I do not need to try to grasp for it in this moment. I do not need to try to make something, you know, to try to bring glory to myself here, right? So we can talk about those options and you can kind of ruminate on those. I will tell you that probably I would lean toward option three, which is Mary wants Jesus to fix the problem and in doing so, kind of show his true identity. And we can talk about why more, but that's kind of where I'm leaning right now. Okay, so Jesus responds, what to me to you? My hour has not yet come. Mary's response is, do what he says. She turns, she looks at the servants, do what he says. Okay, so regardless of Mary's motivation here, notice what she does. Her response puts Jesus on the spot, right? Jesus gets sort of thrust into the moment. He may have said, what to me and to you, but even so, Mary is insistent. Mary ultimately says, do what he says, right? So the question is Mary forcing something upon Jesus that he has just told her that he doesn't want to do? That's possible. Has Mary understood him clearly? Maybe she hasn't. And so knows that he will, but maybe she has. But if so, maybe she's understood that Jesus is saying, I'm not going to ultimately reveal myself to all these people right now, but I can do something. I can help here. Maybe that's what Mary's understood him to be or to mean. So, of course, we know for Mary, when Mary hears Jesus say, my hour is not yet come, Mary has no idea what Jesus means necessarily. We, the reader, from hindsight, know Jesus is talking about his crucifixion and his resurrection. Mary likely simply thinks he's talking about that moment when he gets to ascend, right? To sort of take on his true identity in front of Israel. Okay, so Jesus' command. What we see then now is his mother says to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Verse 6, now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. So if you add that up, there's these 6 big stone water pots. They appear to be empty, it says, and they were they held 20 to 30 gallons each. So that's a total of somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons. Okay? They potentially hold a lot of water. And so Jesus says, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. Now, Jesus complies with his mother's request. And his command is curious. fill the stone water pots with water. Well, we just, like, that's a lot of water, right? Where are the servants going to get this water, right? You notice that in the way John has recorded this, verse 7 goes by really quickly. Fill the water pots. They fill them to the brim. Well, this is like first century Israel, right? Even if there was an aqueduct like parked up against the back of the, you know, this property, right? It's going to take, which of course is ridiculous. Like, I'm just trying to imagine, like, if I had 180 milk jugs, gallon jars, and I have my hose, like, that's going to still take me a while to fill all of those 180 gallons, right? And where are they going to get this water? Like, maybe a well? So, I mean, they're not on the lake. They're not right on a river. They don't got an aqueduct parked on, you know, up against the back. So you can imagine these servants are like, you want us to do what? Like, and for what purpose? Like, I think our problem is we're out of wine, right? So imagine yourself in one of the servant's shoes and how you would be experiencing that moment, right? We have bigger problems, right? Like, I don't know what they were thinking. Like, okay, we're out of wine. I guess we're going to serve water. So it's important that we just recognize that there is this human element of this disconnect in this moment, and imagining ourselves in the shoes and what must have passed in terms of the time it would have taken them to actually fulfill this request, in terms of the feelings and or misgivings that they would have had, you know, to like, what? So, but they do this. Time passes. We don't know how much time has passed. They do this and they've filled them up to the brim. And Jesus's second command to the servants may be more ridiculous than the first. Okay. He says, draw some out now and take it to the head waiter. And again, the servants, like, what might be going through their mind. So, there's two options here. The main question is, when does the miracle take place? Okay, when does it take place? And the two options are, it takes place when the servants draw out the water, and as they're drawing out the water, presumably in some sort of jug, to then go present it to the head waiter, that they notice that something's changed. That's one option. Option number two is that they draw the water out, it's still water, they take it to the head waiter, and it's not till the head waiter actually tastes what they've handed to him that it's changed, and the head waiter then praises the wine, right? He like, so the question is, you know, either way, these servants have to be thinking, we're out of wine. I think, and I could be wrong about this, and we can talk about it in the time, the discussion time, but I'm like hedging towards that, in fact, the miracle doesn't take place until the head waiter actually like drinks it. And here's why. Notice that it says that he asked them to draw some of the water out and take it to the head waiter, right? And it says they took it to him, and when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine, okay? So he tastes the water which had become wine. Well, when has it become wine? Well, and then it says, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. Now, the verb to draw, go draw, the command to draw, was not given when they were told to fill the pots. That's a different command. Fill is different than draw. So the servants were asked to draw that water out, and the parenthetical remark, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. So it makes me think potentially that even after they had drawn the water out of one of those pots, that it was still, at least for them, maybe it wasn't clear that this had, the change had already taken place. Now, do I know that for sure? Am I going to die on that hill? No. But It's interesting to think about. Okay, the head waiter's response is very ironic. He says, he calls the bridegroom and he says to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then that," Bob was exactly right in his translation. The verb is literally "when they have got drunk," right? When men have got drunk, that which is poorer is served. "But you have kept the good wine until now." Okay? Now imagine being the bridegroom. The bridegroom may or may not know that the wine had already been out, but let's pretend he does. Does the bridegroom know what's happened? He doesn't. He has no idea what's happened. And here is the head waiter praising him for what he has done and saving this good wine. And it is in this way, this irony, that Jesus fulfills his mother's request while also maintaining what was important to him, that is, keeping his true identity at this time a secret. So the irony here is someone else is getting praised for what Jesus has done, but Jesus has successfully fulfilled his mother's request and done what was important to him, not brought glory to himself. But in the process, notice, Jesus brings glory to his host. Jesus selflessly, in a way, it ultimately allows the host to receive the glory of what he's done. And I think that's pretty cool. Okay, so that's the literal level of the story. Okay, so we're doing good here. Now we need to talk about the symbolic level. There's an interesting reality to this event. It becomes, for John, the author and his narrative, the first of a very selective, small sample of miracles which John narrates. John narrates much fewer ultimate miracles in his gospel account than do the synoptics. And for this reason alone, that John has selected a very small sampling of miracles to highlight, right? For that reason alone, it feels significant that here is the first one he's chosen to record. Secondly, John has just placed Jesus, narratively speaking, in the position just prior of declaring to his disciples that they will see greater things, that there is a revelatory glory of his which they will personally witness. No longer is it just going to be John the Baptist witness that is causing them to follow, but now Jesus is going to witness to them through the signs, the miracles that he does. It is this miracle which directly follows that, through which we as readers are primed to connect to Jesus' declaration of revelatory vision. We are ready. Jesus has just told his disciples, and John has just told us, the readers, secondarily, there is glory about to be shown, right? I'm about to show you greater things. We as readers have also been primed through the prologue, have been told that this Logos has become flesh, and that we have beheld his glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. And what do we get here? We get Jesus thrust into an awkward position by his mother at a party to make a family blunder disappear. Namely, that they've run out of wine. Impressive enough that this miracle is, and by the way, 180 gallons of wine, that's 900 bottles. 5 bottles of wine is a gallon. And if these stone water pots actually contained 180 gallons, then the amount of wine Jesus has produced is a lot. This is way more than would have been needed. It is abundant. So impressive enough as this miracle is, nonetheless, it's veiled. Not very many people see it. And compared to what he's going to go on to do to heal the blind man who was blind from birth in front of a lot of people, to heal the paralytic who had been in his sickness for 38 years, to raise Lazarus from the dead, compared to feeding the multitudes, compared to this, changing some water into wine kind of feels like a cheap party trick, right? Not only that, but it's, as I mentioned, its viewership was small. It's not a miracle that is performed for a larger audience. So how exactly is this glory, as John calls it, glory that is full of grace and truth? How especially so when, as mentioned, Jesus doesn't even appear to be the one in control of the situation, but is, according to John, thrust into the moment by his mother. This is John's first sign that he chose to share. This is the glory that we have been waiting for. But how is it? How is it that? What is the meaning of this moment? John calls it a sign. While all the synoptic accounts call the miracles that Jesus do acts of power or mighty deeds, John refers to the miracles that he has selected as signs, attesting miracles, essentially. And I think he does it for a reason, because ultimately John tells us at the end of his gospel, I've brought these signs together for you, my readers, so that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. That these signs were to point to Jesus's what? To Jesus's identity. By believing you, or I've chose these signs so that you might believe who he is, that you might know his identity. So how does this changing water into wine show us the identity of Jesus? Okay? How exactly does that work? Well, the symbolic meaning of wine is real. We have several instances in the prophetic material, and two of them were read today out of Isaiah chapter 25 and Amos chapter 9. And there are more so, that wine would be one of those prophetic signs of the time when Israel's fortunes would be reversed. That wine would be in abundance at the time when God was going to gather the people and undo the shroud of death. Wine was also a prophetic sign. You remember back to Philip's words when he goes and gets Nathanael and he says, we have found him of whom Moses and the prophets wrote. Well, there are two places that Moses writes of the coming one, the coming Messiah. One is in Genesis 49 and one is in Numbers when Balaam prophesies. And in Genesis 49, it is Jacob's last words of blessing to his 12 sons. And of Judah, he says that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. And then it says this, he ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth are white from milk. So we have this prophetic text about the coming one that is attached to wine itself, right? So wine was symbolized the reversal of Israel's fortunes. It symbolized the time when God was going to finally come and save his people from their ultimate oppressor. Wine and the banquet of God at the end of time was going to be that time when there would be the choicest wine, fine-aged wine, we read, at the time when God was going to undo death. And so here it is that in this event that seems so, in some ways, commonplace. I mean, yeah, there was the miracle, but it's at a wedding. Jesus changed water into wine. No one really knows except for his mother and his disciples and the servants. And yet, John chooses to record this moment as the cornerstone first moment when Jesus essentially does this attesting miracle that reveals symbolically that he's the one who is going to come and do what God had promised. He is the Messiah. And interestingly, the hour that Jesus points to in this story, my hour has not yet come, is in fact going to be the hour of his glorification, his death and resurrection, which will be the vehicle through which God undoes the veil of death over all people, as Isaiah 25 says. So this verse 11, this beginning of signs that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, where he manifested his glory. What is his glory? His glory, John tells us from the prologue, is the thing that is full of grace and truth. This event symbolizes, ultimately, in light of the cross, who it is who Jesus is and what he's doing for us. That's a big deal, right? Okay, we're going to sing a song and then we're going to open it up for Q&A. Questions, thoughts, implications. There's a lot going on here. You guys, what are we going to talk about?
Yeah, Jeff. So, just kind of kick things off. I was researching the Sabbath or Shabbat rituals of Jews, and the role of wine is very prominent, that at the beginning and the end, that there's the blessing of the light, the candle, the wine, and the bread. Mm-hmm. And so seeing how the traditions have come down through us through communion, and Jesus being the light of the world, the bread of life, and with you making mention of that when he comes to make things right, that the wine will flow in righteousness. So it's like, whoa. And also at the tail end of the Sabbath time, that it's a cry out for Elijah to come to usher in Mashiach. And like, my goodness, we're just totally in the crosshairs. This is trippy.
Yes, John the Baptist as the Elijah to come.
Yeah.
Here comes Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, John. Thank you. Robbie.
You talked about that not a lot of people knew about it, and so in essence, Jesus wasn't all about his glory then because his hour had not come. Mm-hmm. But then we get to verse 11, and it says he did manifest his glory. I don't know what you're thinking about it, but he said his disciples believed in him. So it is the miracle, since so few people knew about it, and yet somehow it was a confirming miracle to mm-hmm. them. And maybe mostly for them? And is that why John, one of the reasons that he would have picked it? I mean, I think all the things you said about wine, that's great. I mean, that is very interesting and mm-hmm. a lot to think about. But did you have more thoughts on the fact that it says particularly that his disciples believed him?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, Robbie. So it's interesting that what we have in chapter 1, John the Baptist gives testimony. The first two disciples hear his testimony. They go follow Jesus. They then go find Peter. They start picking up people, this chain of witness. But in no place in this chain do we have the statement that any of these people believed. Jesus says to Nathanael, because I said this to you, do you believe? But the author doesn't say in any of these other cases that, in fact, there was this belief, right? And so I think what John is doing is he's essentially saying these disciples who had heard that he was the Messiah, had heard that this was the Lamb of God, had heard that he was the one who was going to be baptizing in the Spirit, and had had enough interaction with him to be like, whoa, like, we remained with him, we hung out with him, and like, we got to go tell other people about him. But that it wasn't until Jesus, in this first instance, himself witnesses of himself by manifesting his glory, does John record that his disciples actually in this moment like believe, right? Now, belief is tricky in John's gospel because while it is true that these guys initially believe, we do know that a lot of people come to, quote, believe in him along the way, and a lot of those people leave him, right? And even, of course, his disciples all leave him right before his hour. But I think what John is essentially saying is that what Jesus did allowed them to confirm in themselves what the testimony that they had heard. Does that make sense? There may have been other parts to your question, but...
I was a little confused at the end. Is it, when you were talking about, like, the bridegroom, it was in a sense he got glory for having the good wine and Jesus didn't, and you made that point. But in 11 it says that Jesus did manifest his glory. So it wasn't manifesting his glory in front of people, but there was something about the act of that that did manifest his glory.
Yeah, so what I'm, how I'm thinking, yeah, so he did. What he didn't do was to glorify himself in front of Israel in that way that Mary may have been hoping that he would do in that moment. But when it says he manifested his glory, what I'm doing is I'm taking my cues from the prologue where John says, and we beheld his glory. What was that glory? It was full of grace and truth. So here is an act on Jesus's part that reveals the symbolic meaning underneath the actual event, reveals that he is a bringer of grace and truth, that in fact, this is the Messiah. The guy that we had testimony about, yep, that's him. That this act of changing water into wine and what that wine actually symbolizes, that allows us to recognize, whoa, there's something full of grace and truth here. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's kind of curious that there had to be a whole lot of servants doing that stuff, I would assume. And they just did what they were told and kind of muddled along without much faith in what was going to happen. But wouldn't they all have known in the end that all of the work they did and were told to do actually happened?
Yes. So presumably...
They all know.
So, yeah, so... you know, John has that note that the head waiter didn't know where the wine came from, but the servants did. So, yes, so even though it is Jesus, his disciples, who come to, quote, believe in him, I think that belief comes from the fact that his disciples had received specific testimony already. They already had been primed to say, others were saying, like, this is who this is. Whereas the servants may or may not have known that. Clearly the servants were aware this guy that was at the party did something incredible, and they probably shared that information with other people. But it wouldn't have been in that moment. Like, we don't have the sense that, like, all of a sudden, all heads at the wedding turn to Jesus, right? And they're like, oh my gosh, he did this thing, right?
So it all happened behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where all the servants were.
Right, yeah, yeah. But that's a good point. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Yeah.
Was John at the wedding? Was the author at present?
I assume that John, it tells us that Jesus and his disciples were at the wedding.
Okay.
And if in fact John is the unnamed disciple who was with him from the beginning, that John would have had direct eyewitness kind of access to this.
Yeah. That makes sense. I have a couple other thoughts. I'm not sure I agree with your logic, but thank you, Ryan, for this. This was really helpful today because I always found this as the first miracle a bit strange
right.
in light of the others, but this was really, so thank you for your work. I don't agree with you, respectfully.
That's okay. Yeah, bring it on.
I think that at the point at which the wine water turned to wine, because I have a hard time believing that a servant would have been willing to take a cup of water to
maybe so.
The headmaster. But, mm-hmm. but maybe, yeah, anyway. The other thing that struck me, so, but the sheer volume that you really drove this point, and reflecting on the two parallel narratives of redemptive history, shalom and empire,
mm-hmm.
we have abundance and scarcity, and this abundant, this was a lot of wine. So it was either a really, really big wedding, or that's kind of a more powerful message or statement than I had previously recognized.
I have to believe that there was something about the abundance of it that really spoke to at least the disciples, that this was, because in the prophetic text, like the wine, the mountains are literally dripping with wine. There's vines everywhere, and there is. So I think that the real sign there is not just that wine or water got turned into wine, but that it was so much wine. Yeah.
Yeah. How long would a wedding go on?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
From what I the
a
little
wine.
What's that?
For the wine farm.
Yeah, that's right.
I was thinking back and going, yeah, I short-shirted myself. I should have more wine.
Yeah, I don't know, Dom. I think that what I've heard is that the party could last for several days. Whether or not, you know, there was the exact same feasting and partying on every day and that sort of thing, I don't know. But I hear from what I've read that these were potentially like multi-day kind of events. So, but I don't have a specific answer for you.
So, one thing that struck me, I'm thinking about Mary and her interaction with Jesus as she's going there.
Do you mean the mother of Jesus?
It seems to me, and I think you said this, but it seems to me that she knew that Jesus could do miracles.
I think so.
Because she comes up to him and says, "We're out of wine." And he gives this cryptic response. And then she says, "Do what he says." Like, he is going to perform a miracle. Like, she knows he is going to perform a miracle at that time.
It feels like it.
It sure feels like that's what's going on. Yeah. But the whole point of her saying, "Do what he says." Because if he's not going to perform a miracle, then she's saying that makes no sense whatsoever, right? If she doesn't know that he's going to perform a miracle.
Right.
So she knows he can perform miracles somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the question is, how does she know that he can perform miracles? Or what's going on behind the scenes there that she knows? Is he like, has he been doing a bunch of things at home or something like that?
You know, card tricks.
I need some more flour, Jesus. Could you come over here and give me some more flour? But somehow she knows. And so I'm trying to think about the whole sort of history of these last few, the John 1, John 2, the structure is going through here. And I like what you said earlier about the fact that all the disciples are being called, on the testimony
mm-hmm.
of John the Baptist and other people and so on and so forth. Jesus hasn't done any miracles yet.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody has seen Jesus come and do miracles or anything like that. And I don't know, maybe you're going to talk about this later, but at least in the other Gospels, there's definitely a theme of Jesus sort of revealing himself over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, he doesn't want to sort of make a big splash early on because, and again, he says, this is not my hour.
Right.
And the hour, I mean, I think you're right also, the hour that he's pointing to is the hour of his death and resurrection because that seems to be what it says later, talking about the hour coming on and stuff like that. So it feels like Jesus is at this point where at least Mary knows that he can do miracles. He must know he can do miracles. And she's like, whether she wants him to perform them publicly or not, he realizes that performing a miracle here in a public setting is going to set the stage for what's coming. It's sort of like, okay, so far it's just been testimony. Now we're coming in power. Now we're doing signs and miracles and so on and so forth. But he kind of wants it to be on the down low.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that because the waiter, like, he didn't understand what was going on. So there is a certain amount of hiddenness to this whole thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not so hidden that the disciples didn't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like the story is sort of like, okay, we're starting now. We're like, we're moving forward. We're doing it in a way that the disciples can see it. We're not doing it super public. We don't want to like bring this negative attention to me, but we're going to get started, and the disciples see it, and they're believing. That's kind of the feel that I got from the whole structure of what's going on. Mary knew it's coming. Now she's like, okay, let's get started, or something along those lines. I don't know. What do you think?
Well,
I mean, I think I mostly agree with you. I'm just sort of putting a different spin on it or a different structure.
Yeah, I liked everything you just said. So the one thing that is interesting to note is that chapter 2 has two events. It has this wedding at Cana with this veiled sign, and then he goes to Jerusalem and he's in the temple and he does this really outrageous thing in the temple. And at the end of that thing, he tells everyone there's a sign coming. Tells them the sign is coming, they're going to destroy the temple, and he's going to raise it up in 3 days. And so there's a sign coming, and we also get this sort of like after kind of epilogue where it says he was in Jerusalem during the Passover, which everyone's in Jerusalem during the Passover, and that everyone was believing, beholding his signs which he was doing. So it's not going to take long for Jesus to like kick into really public gear. But yes, for now, yes, still veiled.
So do you think that Jesus was actually doing miracles prior to this event, or is it just that he had communicated enough to Mary that she knew what was coming? Or do you have any guess? Maybe we don't know.
Yeah, I don't think we know enough to know. We just don't have that kind of information. We have information about Jesus as a 12-year-old and the wisdom that, you know, Luke's gospel tells us that he, you know, remained in Jerusalem and was like questioning the priests and stuff in the temple, and they were marveling at his knowledge and his wisdom. But beyond that, we don't know.
The Apocrypha has like some miracles, right, of Jesus and the child, the sparrow.
So we have like some non-canonical or non-four that are that include Jesus as a younger child that's doing things
not
like
that. It's in the Apocrypha, right?
Well, I'm not familiar with all of what's in the Apocrypha, but certainly like in like some of like the Gospel of Thomas, and I don't know if that's even in the Apocrypha, but yeah, there is. There are writings potentially later that, go for it, Ben.
Well, Mark Conniff, you know, you talked about like the results of what happened here as far as his disciples are believing and the fulfillment of prophecy. And another one of the results of making so much wine and so much good wine, and it's just kind of funny, is that these people are now going to get really drunk. Like, there's going to be this long party. Like, Jesus just did this miracle that's actually going to result. Like, the waiter even says so. He's like, well, this is just, everybody's just about to start getting really drunk. This isn't the best time to bring out the good wine. But okay.
Right. Yep.
Now, and Jesus, like, really enabled that. And it's just kind of a little bit shocking. Like, by our modern like evangelical sensibilities.
Sure.
Bit
yeah. Yeah.
That's all I just wanted to point
out. No, that's good. But I think too, though, that there's something in that. I mean, but there's also this symbolic sort of like representation of this. I mean, there's this image, this prophetic image of this banquet at the end of time that was going to be a lavish banquet, and there's something along, you know, where it would. There's something along the lines of like, this is so lavish. This is so like over the top. And yes, these people get to be really happy for a while, you know. And that's true. You would like to be it this way.
Well, I want to go to lunch now.
Suzanne. Oh, okay. Let's do two more. Was there someone? Dom and then Suzanne.
So we know Mary wasn't perfect, you know, except for in the Catholic Church. But do you think she could have been taken advantage of the fact that Jesus doesn't sin and he was going to be obedient to her?
I don't know. I mean, it's really interesting. Like, clearly there is a sense in which Jesus is being kind of nudged into this by his mother. But there's also a sense in which he's still very much in control. And the thing that he most, seemingly most does not want to do, he does not do, which is to publicly,
right.
You know, so does Mary take advantage? Well, maybe. I mean, wouldn't you?
I mean, the embarrassment says a lot of things, and if she was really embarrassed, or she knew he could solve the problem. And
right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think in Mary's mind, this was a matter of like honor, and this was important.
Yeah,
and it wasn't. It's not like she's getting her own like devious sort of like needs fulfilled or something like that. But yeah, she seems to know that he can do something, and it's interesting that Jesus is willing to do it. Like here is a petitioner who, I mean, clearly he knows her, but like this is not above him. He's willing to care about people. Yeah. All right, last one, Suzanne.
Well, I just had this random thought as we were discussing, if you know God's overall relationship with us being very relational, mm-hmm. like throughout the Bible, and it's so strange this whole like Jesus' ministry launches with this request that he doesn't want to, and maybe think of the Old Testament when Israel or God's people are like asking God for what he's not doing, and then he's like, okay. If you need. Right. And it seemed like a parallel to me, and I didn't know what you thought about that.
Yeah.
If Jesus' ministry is then launched soon thereafter by people, and not being like, please.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really, I really like that. I think that there's some, I think you're right. I think there is something there that just as the children of Israel, like, you know, God had provided for them, but then they were like asking for things like, hey, we really want meat, right? Okay, you want meat? Here's a ton of meat. So yeah, no, I like that, Suzanne. I think that there is a parallel there. Yeah, thank you for that.